Hello, my name is Rahasia, and you're listening to the Spiritual Activist Radio Show, which is a nonprofit. You can visit www.spiritualactivist.com for more information. This is where we're going to question the answers that we've been given. Today we're going to have a conversation with David Cereda. If you've never heard of David Cereda, you should have. Because he delves into everything from the highest levels of science, quantum physics, right on down to the matrix of consciousness. And you can visit David at davidcereda.net. And this is a show being brought to you by Rahasia Uncensored. And thank you very much. I think you'll enjoy this. Hello, David. I've been looking forward to this interview for quite a while. And what I'd like to take the direction of this is into the consciousness realm of science, and specifically quantum physics, because in the early 19th century, people like Max Planck and Heisenberg, it seems like they were in tune with the consciousness that they were dealing with. And this was a new thing with them after the split experiment. And now it seems like we've drifted away from that. And more recently, because of people like yourself, it seems like we're drifting back into this. And it reminds me of a Max Planck quote where he's talking about that science isn't really going to change from the organized foundation. It usually changes from inspired minds that usually sit alone and do their own research. And it also reminds me of Deepak Chopra once said, new ideas die one grave at a time. And I think that that's what's happening now. We're starting to wake up with new minds, new physicists, and people are reaching out for a more conscious perspective of science. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, my film Quantum Communication, which got hijacked on the internet, it's probably passed 50 million views now over the years, and it's people who, you know, take the DVD and upload it. They change the name to Mind Science Kept Hidden, and they've changed the name to a lot of things, but nevertheless, it's gotten a lot of views, and I really think that there's a calling in people to really know how the magnetic field of your heart and your mind, how it is cooperatively involved in all of this. And, you know, Max Planck, I mean, actually I had this woman who was a researcher and a past life regressor who believed I was the reincarnation of Max Planck, and I never really believed her, but I do believe in a sense that I have reincarnated Max Planck's work through that film. And, you know, Planck and Einstein and even Richard Feynman, actually, there's this amazing book called The Strange Theory of Light and Matter, very small book, a very frustrated physicist, Max Planck, he stacks sheets of glass on top of each other, and he sends, you know, light through the different sheets of glass. And he's trying to see if there's a consistent, quantifiable, mathematical way of calculating which photon is going to go through sheet number one, number two, number three, number four. Because what light does is that when it hits an object, some of the photons will bounce off of the object, which is why you can see my hand. Some will go through my hand, and some will interact through the photoelectric effect with the electrons and the subatomic particles inside of my hand. And that is basically photoelectrism, when the light is interacting with my hand or any object. And what we see is the surface of everything. We really only are concerned with the surface. And Planck was trying to see if there was a pattern of which photons were going to bounce off sheet number one or penetrate sheet number one, bounce off the surface of sheet number two, and three, and he went mad because there was no, it was like a person's mind. I mean, the more I looked at his experiment, I said, of course it's not quantifiable because the light itself that you see all around you, both the visible rainbow spectrum and the invisible radio to the ultraviolet, near, far, and extreme, X-rays and gamma rays and super gammas, all of it is conscious. All of it is consciousness. And in fact, when you go into deep states of meditation, and it's taken me my whole life, I'm 56 years old this summer, I'll be 56, And it's taken me my whole life to study with different yogis and yoginis and great teachers and do all these different techniques and the asana yoga and the, you know, the pranayama techniques and the breathing and the sound and get to the point where I can go into the samadhi state regularly. And the samadhi state is so sublime. It's kind of like the boundaries of your awareness disappear, and you're not, it's not like that Yahoo moment where you're on the top of the mountain, you get this huge adrenaline rush and you say, I'm one with everything, and that'll last for about 10 seconds and then you'll start hiking down the hill. This is more like you really dissolve the boundaries and everything is pure light. One of my favorite sayings by Christ was, my burden is heavy, but my yoke is light. And what happens in the state is you're sitting inside of everything, and everything is God, but everything is light. And everything is made of this purest, purest ecstasy that is so sweet and has so many incredible qualities. And in this state, you can look at anything. You can look at a pencil, anything, and you perceive it as God light. As, you know, the word God is actually meaningless. It's a human concept. It's just pure, pure vibration, pure light. Everything you perceive has this inside of it. But when I look at what light itself is, the light itself from the sun, remember, it made this. All the hydrogen that the sun is fusing is basically in your body. Your body is 80% water, you know, or more if you drink a lot of water. So you're made of hydrogen, and hydrogen atoms are mostly empty space. It's just, you know, one electron, one proton in all of this space. So your body is somehow the mind identified so deeply with the physical attributes of the mind. And when it started studying science, it said, I need to be able to perceive the result. But if I can't see that everything is really light, and I can only see data, like if I pull out, you know, I have over here an ion meter, I have all kinds of different electric field meters around here, and none of them can measure you know, your consciousness. They can measure the electric field. There's a little bit of an electric field around the body, and sometimes some static energy will build up around the body. But basically, they can't at that level measure you. So no wonder when Max Planck looked and he came with Heisenberg and they said, it looks like the minds of the researchers are affecting the results.
Speaking
of particle
sound.
Explosions. Yeah, I think my baby's pounding on the door back there. So, she's really just a little light bulb. And so I began to, you know, once you know that the mind is affecting matter and the subatomic reality, well, you're already made of that stuff. You're made of the hydrogen. So you're already, you know, the uncertainty principle of Heisenberg is really the uncertainty of where an electron is in the orbit around the proton is determined by taking a picture of it. But the speed of the electron is so fast, and to capture it, you need shorter and shorter wavelengths of light. And therefore, that means when you take a red light bulb and take a picture of an electron, it's going to be a huge blur. And by the time you get to orange, yellow, red, blue, indigo, and then you get to violet, the electron looks shorter. But the problem is when light hits an object, part of the light interacts with the electrons and speeds them up, right? So you've affected the process of trying to observe where the electron is has already affected it, because you can't take a picture of it and know with any certainty where it is without affecting it, even with a flashbulb, because the different wavelengths of light you're taking the picture with are either speeding it up or slowing it down. And then you get into the time dilation problem, which is really remarkable stuff. Well, one of the very first things I ever did is this film called Evidence, the Case for NASA UFOs, with a cameo with Dan Aykroyd in the front of it. And I built this huge model called the Galaxy Clock. And the Galaxy Clock actually was an experience I had where right at the new millennium, Nikola Tesla and two other beings of light appeared in my room in the middle of the day. I saw them with this blinding light, and he flashed this clock into my consciousness. And this is kind of what it looks like on paper, the beginnings of it here. And that's a stage one galaxy clock. I can see my camera is making a lot of wavy lines there. And that's stage two. And you can see what I'm doing on the clock is I'm actually building a model that you can put any the orbit of any subatomic particle around the nucleus of an atom. You can put any exploded particle from a bubble chamber in this clock. And you can actually put the orbit of a planet around a star or an entire galaxy in this clock. And you can determine what's actually happening inside the clock. And I don't, what happened is you have all these wheels and you have these counting points. And each counting point, the distance is the distance that light travels per second, which is a consistent number of approximately 186,000. 282 point something miles per second.
You know, this almost reminds me of some crop circles.
Well, it does. In fact, you know, once you see my galaxy clock video, which is very old and had mega millions of views in Google Video in those days, and then it pieces of it got on YouTube, because this thing is so mind-bending, it geometrically will show you not only how the galaxy eventually starts to get the spiraling arms, but it shows you that gravity force and space and time, you can see them breaking the speed of light. Geometrically, you can actually see it, and it's really easy to see it occurring. By the more the gravitational lensing or the warping of space-time occurs, it basically it starts to accelerate and accelerate and accelerate. And eventually, as you get near event horizon and a black hole, you're so much faster than the speed of light. So, and what the galaxy clock shows,
David,
is that you...
I was just wondering about something. Like, you've been on this path for a while, and we know that our minds and consciousness affects reality. How much do you think this information has been instrumental in your own internal conscious growth? Like, sometimes when there's an old saying, like, to fully understand something, you set yourself free from that. And that goes for the government, whatever it is, the limitations, all the suppression that's put on us, living down in the matrix. I see the more I understand it, the more I set myself free from it. And sometimes, like the information from Albert Fritz, just realizing
Fritz
that
Albert Pop, yeah.
there are information going from me to another person and back, you know? Just realizing that changes the depth of my communication now with people. How has this affected your life, you think? And what is it that drives you? Because most people, they find it curious, interesting. But what I find curious and interesting about you is you have no trouble at all. Like, if I'm doing my TV show, I pretty much stay away from the alien and the extraterrestrial information because it's just too much for people. But you have no problem with that, and I really admire that. But what drives you to do this personally? Is it a spiritual quest?
Well, you know, when I started with these yogis and, you know, yoginis, you know, when you hang out with the Mother Mira, for example, you can go, she can really assist you to go into this deep, you know, ultimately get to the samadhi state. There's not very many yogis and yoginis in the Western world who have figured out how to go into the samadhi state. And once you start going in the first ones, there are seven of them. The Buddha documents seven of them in the Dhammapada. And the seventh is the Nirvana. So even the Dalai Lama told us when I was in India with him in 96 that there's no way he's in that state. He's not in the supreme Nirvana state. But so you have to master these different levels of the samadhi state. And the levels of ecstasy start to get so sublime and so supreme that the Buddha even says this in many, many sutras, that you can literally get lost in these bliss states for millions of years in the in-between state. So let's say you die and you go into the light and you're floating in this bliss cloud and you think, you know, this is it. I'm fully illuminated. And, you know, sometimes after a million years, the Buddha will come and show them, oh my God, you're nowhere near the Nirvana state yet. You're enjoying yourself. You're having a lot of bliss. but you're still massively diluted. And it's not until you start to take that light and integrate it and do something that changes the situation for everybody do you start to get into the much, much higher states. And you know, at this point, we're in the technological age. And when you have all this technology, we're bombarded by Wi-Fi and microwave towers, over 150,000 microwave towers in the United States alone. There's over 30,000 satellites spinning around the planet, bombarding the planet. And my theory, you know, even as a meditator who has had unbelievable experiences, I mean, some of my experiences in meditation are not believable for a lot of people who start out on the meditation path, like, you know, blinding meetings with Christ and in person and the Virgin Mary and Mary Magdalene. I've had visits with all of them and other masters that no one's ever heard of. But see, what starts to happen eventually is you go, look, if we're bombarding the planet with all these undesirable frequencies, my goal is to get these type of coils that I have back here all over the planet to reshape and reharmonize those fields that we're throwing out of balance. And if you think that, oh, our little microwave towers are nothing compared to the sun, you're wrong. And that is because at this distance between the Earth and the sun, the electromagnetic force on a meter of the sun at close range is so weak compared to all the stuff we're doing,
right,
that the disharmony of what we're doing is actually affecting the entire planet's relationship to the sun and the solar system. Because we were actually, if you read the Vedas, I mean, in the Vedas, which are probably, you know, next to the pyramid text, the oldest surviving literature of any spiritual tradition on the planet, much older than, of course, than Buddha's or Jesus's teachings. And in the Vedas, the relationship between the meditator and the planets and the state, there's desirable qualities of the planets, and then there's the adverse qualities of the planets, or there's your reaction to the great powers of the planets can be the real problem. Not that the planet's a problem, because once you listen to the frequency of Jupiter and Saturn and you study Dante, you'll realize that those planets are vibrating probably in dimensions that are so advanced that if you approach them in an unadvanced state, you're going to have some negative reactions to those planets.
And how did Pythagoras know that this so many years ago? He talks about the music of the spheres, and I mean, he had to be an illuminated person, you know. Hey, tell me something. Going down this road for a second, you know Peter Russell's The Global Brain? Have you ever watched that? It's a whole science built upon, everything is built upon platforms. Like in the beginning, there were subatomic particles that came together into atoms. That built the first platform. Mm-hmm. As everything cooled down, they came together as molecules. That's another platform. Molecules came together as cells. Cells came together as organisms. And then evolution kicks in, and here we are on a planet that's also like a living being, and we're these planetary cells. And if that process continues of connecting, you know, atoms to cells, cells and on up, then the next step is people like you and I, we're connecting. And eventually it will ignite a global Earth brain. And I was talking to Bruce Lipton about this. We were at a backyard party, and that's where I ended the conversation. He says, you know how Bruce is, like he's really animated, you know. He says, that's just the beginning, because at that point, as a global brain, as we connect humanity, we connect with the sun, then we have solar consciousness. Then our sun connects with other stars in the galaxy. Then the galaxy will connect with other galaxies and we'll have universal consciousness again. How do you feel about that? Like, another thing that Bruce...
It's one of the hugest questions. Like, Teilhard de Chardin started this idea with a vision he had. And if you think of each one of our brains like a neural network and the magnetic field around us, how we're all imagine we're like all like my fingers, you know, billions of data sensors. So where is all that getting massively assembled? Is there a central brain for the planet that assembles the entire human experience and collects all that data and experiences it? I mean, what is the experience of human consciousness? And we're starting to see a glimmer of that with the internet. We're starting to see, you know, what do people think about? I mean, how many hits do you, you know, you type into Google and you type the word God and you go, well, how many people on the internet are thinking about God, right? So you, and then you type in, you know, money, and then you type in sex, and you type in meditation, and you'll see where most of the thinking is going on. It's actually money, believe it or not. And sex and those things are probably not far behind it. And the number of people that are really interested in consciousness and God and where this is all going is quite small by comparison. So your global mind is mostly first chakra, survival, right? And just pure sensationalism, adrenaline, you know. So we're an adrenaline-based society, from adrenaline-based sex versus love-based sex, and love-making versus adrenaline-based sensuality, and coffee. I mean, with the advent of the birth of this massive economic age, where you look in space and you see above Los Angeles, where's everybody driving? Why are they driving their cars and burning all that fuel? Well, they're trying to pay for the mortgage and go pay for the, you know, organic food is $2,500 a month for us. So these cars racing around all over the place, burning all this fuel to pay for this fictitious number of a house that's already built. Somebody already built it. Why do you still have to pay for it? Because you believe you do. Because your civilization taught you that, you know, a bunch of people are going to sit back and eat a lot of food or do something with all that money that they're collecting. Because some guys and a couple of girls built this house, and you're gonna pay for it for 30 years. Why? It's already built, sitting there. Build another one. And so I think there are other civilizations that got way past this imprisonment consciousness, and they got to the point like Elon Musk is saying now with artificial intelligence. It's going to get obvious. If humans are going to survive, you're going to have to give them free money, because the AI are going to start building your house and doing your plumbing and your wiring, and they're going to do everything. So if you don't learn to meditate, I mean, to me, I mean, I've been at this meditation thing seriously for 36 years. I meditate every day. Some days I used to put in 4 to 5 hours of the sitting practice, some days three, some days 15 minutes when I was a tree planter for 22 years. During the tree planting days, I might put in an hour at best, because I'm in too much pain. I mean, my body hurt too much at the end of the day. But I never stopped practicing. And it's really come to my attention and consciousness that there's nothing better to do with your consciousness than develop your consciousness. Because what you're experiencing, you can have all the money in the world, and you're still going to have an empty house in Aspen, another empty one in Australia. And you're going to be flying around all over the place and bored everywhere you go, because you're living in the first two chakras that are only give you this temporary, you know, ecstasy, very, very temporary ecstasy. But when you get into the higher levels of consciousness, the superluminal states of consciousness that I can go into, there's nothing that beats it. There's not a single human experience that can compare to these super states of consciousness. And so therefore there's nothing better you can do than to, what I found is, yes, there are ways of using gems in the development of your consciousness. And, you know, for example, this is an ordinary pen laser, and we vibrate. This is a sapphire in this Fibonacci ratio little cap. You see those lines are all Fibonacci ratio. And, you know, we have these on my site. So what would happen if you took a sapphire, you know, really high-end gem, and you vibrate that sapphire with the sound of the sun with our three stages of our technology, and then you take that purified mantra-like gem, and then you point it, you know, at your pineal gland at night. Well, when I did it to my children, they were all wild because, you know, they're jumping around the bed. And so I hit their acupuncture points, you know, with the gem laser. And my one daughter there, she went into the deepest trance of peace. And I checked on her an hour later, and her hand didn't even move. She didn't even roll over. It's just, you know, it just that beautiful sapphire light, you know, the indigo light hitting, you know, my camera is so bright, but you can see if I...
Right.
I point this, you know, yeah. It's the light is passing through the gem, right? And then we have these really fancy flashlight tube wands that have rubies and tourmaline, and they connect to a stereo amplifier, and we have a menu of frequencies that you can transmit into your water. You can hold this and hit your third eye, your heart chakra. And we did aura camera tests before and after. And it showed the person had a massive increase in light in their chakras that held 3 days later. 3 days later, the auras were retested. And with ordinary sound healing, you would never see the results holding for 3 days. So why is, because this is your question, why is it that technology can be inversely, if you harmonize the right frequencies into the body, can it assist your consciousness development? Whereas most people are saying EMF, is hurting me. It's all hurting me. The microwave towers are hurting me. My idea is to let's reharmonize the electricity around you with one of these coils in the house or a more portable type wand and be in control of the frequencies from a menu. You know, you can put the frequency of Earth, Jupiter, Saturn, Venus, Mercury
a little pendant, you know, that I bought mm-hmm. from EarthCom. And mm-hmm. I guess the proof is in the fact that it seems to work. If I'm at the computer for like 8 hours, I get a headache. But with this, I don't. You know, I don't know if it's the placebo right. effect or what, but it seems to ground me somewhat, you know.
Well, crystal stones, like, you know, on our website at davidsarita.net, we have the vibrationally treated pendants and we have the coils. We have the mantras, transmitters, we have the wands, and we have this ancient Egyptian music scale toning meditation course. And I'm not saying I'm the only guy and the only person out there, the only woman selling, you know, pendants and things, but I am saying that as a person who's been on this path for 36 years, if you live in the Western civilization, you are bombarded by microwaves. And microwaves that are tuned to all the wrong frequencies that are making it difficult for you to reach the samadhi state. Once you master this secret of how to get into this state, and I really believe, and I'm not being facetious saying this, that a lot of the yogis and yoginis teaching us from India, the translation into our language and the way they teach yoga and meditation will not work for you as a European or Western person, because you're not from their culture. You need to understand that there's no God judging you for anything you ever did. There's no one. If you do this right and that right, you do this technique perfectly, the alternate, and then all of a sudden the heavens say, this student is so good, heavens open and the bliss comes in. The bliss in the universe is there all the time. It never left. It's actually hidden inside of all things, animate and inanimate. It's really just you getting rid of the idea of the parental figure that anyone else is in control of your consciousness based on your performance. You know how we take kids in school and we give them different grades? You know, you got an A, you got a C-, you got a D, you failed. Right? That whole system of teaching children that you're an excellent, you know, student and you're not, so therefore you can't do this job up here. I'm going to do this job up here because, you know, I know how to do all the math, or I don't know how to do the math, so I'm going to do this job.
You're saying this about meditation. My experience with meditation was I was into sort of a party kind of a life. back in the early 90s, mm-hmm. late 80s, and I was taking drugs. I wanted to quit drugs, but I didn't want to go to 12-step meetings saying, just for today, that would just drive me to drinking, to be honest with you. So I ran into mm-hmm. some people that were doing these meditations in San Diego, and I did a 9-day intensive, and these meditations were like very active meditations, you know, based upon some of Alexander Lowen's bioenergetic movements, things like that. And it mm-hmm. grounded mm-hmm. me out. It gave me a moment of clarity. And if you have to do something, it's fine. Look behind you.
You're taking the truck?
Yes, sir.
Okay, take the walkie-talkie and turn it on. It's by the...
Oh, wow, look at this little one. Oh, my God.
Bye.
God, she's so cute.
There's the tiny bear.
She is so cute. My goodness.
And then, you know, my daughter, Alira, here, she had an experience. She goes into these orations that can last over an hour where she describes that how we were all actually created in the sun. And God, you know, Jesus was created by the sun. The sun gave birth to Jesus and all these masters and then projected them down to the earth. And she just starts talking and all this stuff comes out of her. And actually in her room one night, this big beach ball sized ball of light came into her room and was blowing all the curtains and all the things were blowing around. And she said Jesus and Mary Magdalene came out of the ball of light.
What are their names?
And angels?
Yes, and angels.
And angels came out of the ball of light. And it came into her room a number of times. And we met another little boy at the hot springs who he came up to Alira and told her.
This must be Crystal here, huh?
This is my wife, Crystal.
Hi there.
Hi, how are you doing?
This is Rahasia. And this
Rahasia,
is.
Rahasia, nice to meet you.
This nice is Astaria, Rose, Sarita, and this is Alira.
Hi.
My daughter, Alira. So you have a walkie-talkie?
Yeah, we're just trying to catch a gymnastics class.
Oh, my God. I have to get there on the bike. Though.
It looks like they're already starting.
Astaria, we're going to gymnastics. Just turn her toward me.
There you
go. There
you
go. Okay,
bye, Birdie.
Bye. Nice to meet you.
Bye.
Bye.
So, I forgot what we were talking about there.
You know what? When something like that happens, it doesn't even matter. You know,
it
makes you realize what is really important, David, in life. You know, it's our relationships. It's how we live our life. You know, everything else is sort of everything else. But just I know.
Exactly. I mean, my children are my greatest, you know, source of meditation energy. You know, there are times when my daughter Lyra just plays with her little toys. And I just feel the sweetest bliss coming from and just filling my whole. There's a point where the physical nervous system needs to be blissed out. And that's they call that Ananda bliss in India, in the ancient Vedic system, which is the first bliss. It's the bliss of the body. And it doesn't last like a permanent state. And a lot of the breathing and the physical work and doing the you know, exercising the body and getting it moving, you know, Osho had a lot of those type of meditations. I was a student of Osho's and lived with him in Oregon for a year. And
oh, really?
I did his meditations for
my wife was up in Oregon too. And the meditations
really?
I was talking about, I asked him, where, mm-hmm. where did you learn these meditations? And they learned them from Osho, which took me on mm-hmm. a trip. I went to India, to Pune, and spent a few months there learning the deeper aspects of that dynamic meditation. But my wife teaches
dynamic meditation.
Huh?
Yeah, you do that 10 days in a row. You do dynamic 10 days in a row, and it's incredible.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I've actually taken some of Osho's meditations and changed them a bit and made them into, like, I have one called The Breath of God. It's 45 minutes of this deep, slow inhale. The belly goes in, chest, sip in the chest, and then long, slow, but not a controlled exhale. And you're doing this to music and a guided meditation for 45 minutes. You do any of these meditations, and dynamic is very rigorous. You know, you breathe like crazy through the nose. You're blindfolded. and then you pound on your chest and scream like a monkey and cathart, and then you jump up and down and say the mantra,
Actually, my wife, Dara, was teaching those kinds of meditations, and it was difficult to teach people unless they really build up to it. So she made a CD. I'll send you the CD. She made a CD. It's like a simplified form of it, but it's still highly energetic. And the way I explain it to people, in our culture, the Western culture, we are so suppressed by government, parents. I mean, all of our lives we're told to go to our room, stop fidgeting, stop jumping around, and we do.
Right.
We lock all that up. But like your little kids there, you know, she didn't want to go away. So what did she do? She went dynamic, you know, she went releasing that energy. Mm-hmm. But normal parents would try to hush her up, you know. But as kids, we know what to do. We know how to release that. And I think in the Western world, we need to learn how to release that energy in a conscientious way. Too many times, it builds up, and these people end up in the top of a tower with a high-powered rifle releasing that energy. But if we could do that on a daily basis...
Yeah, our culture relies on adrenaline. It relies on huge amounts of money to survive. And it unfortunately, it's a money-based, adrenaline-based civilization. I mean, the centers of our cities are big, you know, football stadiums and places where you have highly adrenalized sports and you got cheerleaders jumping around. And you, that's what we're about. I mean, whereas in ancient Egypt, instead of the football stadium, you had the pyramids. And so you had people, obviously, who were adepts, who were working inside of the pyramids on advancing their consciousness and reporting back to their leaders about what they experienced and saw. Imagine a civilization where that is the pinnacle of the civilization, is you have spiritual adepts who were reporting on messages from God and the angels, like my daughter just told you. And that was the center of the civilization, and you took that information to therefore build your civilization. And one of the many messages I got about civilizations that I've met in person and right in front of me with my eyes open, not in a trance or eyes closed state, is that they look at us and our real estate and our enslavement in these mortgages as a stage of evolution that they got out of, you know, thousands of years ago, because they realize once you have the ability to make people homes so fast and so easily, and the materials are there, there's no point in enslaving them, because you want to free their mind so they can use their mind to figure out how to go into space. And so we're you know, our billion population keeps expanding, you know, next to 8-9 billion, and we should be sending colonies, you know, to the other planets fast, not, you know, many, many months going to Mars. And obviously, there are civilizations that have figured out how to move around much faster than we can. So you can't just keep pumping out billions of people on one little planet and just keep them all here. And the way we're doing it is we're burning all this fuel, polluting the ecosphere, and most of the driving of the vehicle is them doing a job to pay for that little box they come to every night that was already built 10, 20 years ago. So why are we doing it? Because we're actually like, I don't even want to say apes or monkeys, because they're smarter. They don't pay rent. They don't charge each other rent. That we're so unintelligent on that level, because we believe, hey, look, you know, the people at the top, I can just keep collecting this money if this person's going to run around in their car and they're going to do 3 jobs, 4 jobs and send me the money every month. And if they don't, they have to live on the street. So because there's the threat of them living on the street, they're going to run around like crazy to pay for this stuff.
Yep.
And it's the people at the top with all the strings that are getting a kick out of that somehow.
And I think crazy is the key word here, too. Mm-hmm. Because collectively,
it's crazy.
Yeah, we seem a little bit insane, but there's individuals, and this brings me up. Do you know what imaginal cells are?
No.
Okay, this is something Bruce Lipton was telling me about, because we were talking about what we're talking about here, how civilization has got to this point where it has to change. He said this has to do with a butterfly and a caterpillar. So as the caterpillar is becoming a butterfly, Bruce was telling me what they've discovered is after the caterpillar has this internal thing that happens and it doesn't understand why, it hangs upside down, spins a chrysalis, and everything, every cell in that caterpillar's body is starting to break down, and it tries to hold on to that caterpillar pattern. But as it's breaking down and totally becomes chaos, if you'd open it up, it's just nothing. But within that chaos, there are specific cells, and in biology they call them imaginal cells. It's these specific cells located throughout this chaos that holds the pattern of becoming a butterfly. And now they know what happens. Around those imaginal cells, it starts reorganizing and using the old caterpillar regime that's breaking down and reorganizing it into a butterfly, envisioning what it can be. And I think it's people like you, Bruce Lipton, myself to a certain degree, we're imaginary cells, and we see the old regime, the old caterpillar regime breaking down, but there's so much of it that we can use and reorganize if we hold a vision of what we are to become. And we maybe don't even have to know exactly what that is, because maybe it's an internal spiritual clock that's ticking away right now and letting us morph into what we are truly meant to be. I always thought that was such a good example to overlay that on our society. And you can see that our society is breaking down. It's becoming its own worst enemy. Everything in our society is overtaxed. We have a financial system based upon commercialism based upon finite resources. And we're trying to make a system, financial system, that has to infinitely grow, basing it on something that it's finite. That obviously can't work. We're overtaxing the people. The whole system is shaking now. It's starting to break down, but there are people within this system that are starting to look at that, you know, maintaining a balance, not getting sucked into the chaos, but looking at it and going, okay, it's time to envision a new world, a new way to be. I always thought that was a really great way to look at this.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, that's why, I mean, my vision is seeing how I believe frequency determines and influences your state of consciousness more than anything. There's nothing more than frequency that does that. And when you look at the five brainwave states that we've invented, these five states, from the deep theta to delta to alpha, beta, and gamma, and you go to super gammas. And, you know, when I took NASA's measurements of the nine planets, you know, the radius and the diameter times pi to get the distance around the equators of the nine planets, and I took the speed of light divided by that to determine their frequencies of the nine planets, and I said, oh, my God, those all fit within the different brainwave states of the human system. And therefore, at the speed of light, those wavelengths must be determining our different states of consciousness that we move in and out of. And the planet Mercury, for example, is just a tad under 20 hertz at the equator. And then the frequency changes as you get near the poles, the frequency gets higher because the wavelength is shorter, and you get to your equator and you go, wow. So when Mercury goes retrograde, when Mercury goes behind the sun and we lose contact with that 20 hertz cycle, everybody seems to go out of balance. Well, what's amazing about 20 hertz is it's upper alpha beta brain waves, you know, and that's high focus for the brain. That's when the brain is active. And in fact, one of the reasons we make motion pictures at 24 frames a second is because the brain, when it's relaxed but focused and awake, hangs out there. So if you run your fingers in front of your face right now, you'll see a little strobe trail.
Right.
And that little strobe trail is because the waves in the brain, the peaks of the waves is where most of the optical information is. In the valleys, there's less information, so you see a strobe trail. And then that's how your mind is perceiving reality. So when Mercury goes retrograde, everybody loses the 20 hertz, and they go a little bit, things go a bit crazy. People get in car accidents, they make mistakes, and then when it comes back, you know, you get that focus again. And I was really interested in why that was. So when I measured the wavelengths of the other planets and the moons, it's a very, and you listen to them, they're all on my website, by the way, davidsereda.net. Sereda is S-E-R-E-D-A.net. And you'll see, you can actually hear, because I compress and I scale the frequencies all the way up the poles. And when you listen to the different planets, they're so beautiful to hear, just beautiful.
Actually, and we were just listening to this when you did the interview with Art Bell. We took a trip to San Francisco to pick up somebody at the airport, and I put it on my little iPod, and we were listening to this driving, you know. It was interesting sound.
Right, I was playing some of the sound.
Yeah.
We were doing, I think I played the Pleiades for Art.
The five stars, the Pleiades. I think you played Saturn, too.
Right. So what happens is when you realize that your brainwave states are probably being the master assemblage points of the different wavelengths are the planets themselves, like a giant xylophone set, then you realize where most likely where all the data in the human experience is being assembled is the planets. And then all, it goes all the way back to the sun and the sound of the sun. Is where the mantra Om comes from. And my wife said she couldn't work my truck, so I guess they're staying.
Do you need to take a break and go do something?
Oh, just in a minute when I finish this thought. So what we did is, you know, with the wands, you can transmit the frequency of Earth. And the beauty of this, if you hold a magnet near when you're transmitting Earth, the neodymium magnet will move in your hand like this. So you can't hear between 7 and 8 hertz, right? Because it's too low for the ear to cognitively hear. But you can transmit that wave into your system, and it will relax you. That's why when you walk barefoot on the earth, you know, it's so calming. But when you go to sleep, see, we dream at the frequency of Earth. What's amazing is the dreaming and the rapid eye movement phase of dreaming, which is usually early morning, you're in theta. But when you're deep dreamless state, you're in deep, delta.
Delta.
Deep delta is the deep state. And the planets that are in delta are the bigger planets. So when you get to Saturn and Jupiter, Uranus and Neptune are all deep deltas. And the delta planets are the deepest, deepest consciousness. In fact, if you can be coherent in delta, then you're a real master, you're a really good meditator. And I had my brainwaves mapped for fun by a brainwave mapper. And he couldn't believe that my alphas, which is coherency, meaning I'm aware, and my deltas were huge. They were hitting the end of the meter. He couldn't see how far they went. And I'm sitting there meditating under the tree. And he said, this is impossible because you're supposed to be asleep, not dreaming, not conscious.
Right.
So that unconscious part of human sleep, it's not really unconscious, and they call it the unconscious, which is, and just above the super unconscious is where you're programming when you're an infant, all your, because infants go into that deep delta all the time when they're breastfeeding and sleeping, and above that you have the frequency of Earth, which is where we dream, so all the imagery and pictures, so we dream at our frequency of our planet. Well, that makes sense, right?
Right.
So therefore, what would happen if you were from another planet? You would dream at the frequency of that planet. And so therefore, if I could change your frequency to the frequency of a distant star system like Sirius, which I can do with one of these or one of those, because I have a recording of the frequencies of Sirius A and B, and I can transmit them into your space, and you'll slowly start to resonate with Sirius. And you start dreaming with that consciousness of that star. And anybody, see, there doesn't have to be a physical person in another star system for there to be life. Because we know, you know, the 21 gram theory, when you die, you lose a little bit of weight. We know that the magnetic force that leaves the body at the time of death has a weight to it. It's actually got a presence. And there can be beings like that living on other star systems, even if NASA doesn't believe there can be physical beings living on star systems that have different temperature zones than we do, which is a ridiculous theory of theirs. But anyway, temperature, you know, there have been saints documented in the Catholic Church walking into a burning furnace to move some logs around, and they walk out, and even their brown scapular robe doesn't even sustain a burn. And that's because if you change the frequency of a person, then that the temperature they experience in the fire doesn't exist. So you could exist in a higher vibrational star system. Like Pleiades are very hot young stars, right? They're much younger than our sun. Our sun is an oldie, you know, 4.5 billion-year-old sun. And there are Pleiadian suns that are 700, 600, 500 million years old. Very young stars. So they burn hotter. So there she goes. She wants something. So what I'm saying is, what frequency determines your states of consciousness more than anything.
She's your doing dynamic meditation.
She's doing dynamic meditation. Absolutely. Your ability to be aware in these deep, sublime, what are called unconscious states, that is determined by your level of practice. And so mantras, which are words that are animated at particular pitches and vibrations, are certain frequency vibrations that you use your voice to make to tune your chakras and nervous system to that meaning of that mantra. And the meaning of the mantra is not in the head. It's an experience.
Right.
So this is a coil that's wound at the sacred angle of the Great Pyramid, 51 degrees and 51 minutes. And therefore, that has, I mean, we found in the Great Pyramid mathematics a music scale superior in tonal quality to Pythagoras' scale. And if you go to my YouTube channel or my website, you can and get some good headphones on. These are expensive AKGs, but I can hear 11 hertz on these, by the way. So it's not true that you can't hear below 20 hertz. It depends on how strong the signal is on the lower frequencies. You can definitely hear. I can even hear lower. In the middle of the night when it's quiet, I put these on. And I do some testing with different frequencies, and I can hear the really low frequencies very well. And I think a lot of humans, and you can feel the frequency of Earth. You may not, you can feel a pulse in the whole magnetic nervous system, right? So for those people who are out there who don't believe they're electrical, you just take a voltmeter, a common voltmeter, and you turn it to the millivolt setting. A millivolt is a thousandth of a volt, and then you put your fingers on and wet my fingers a little bit, and there's my, there I am. There's my voltage. It's right there, right? You see? So any electrical system, which we are, is going to be affected by electrical transmissions and electrical fields. And the sun and the planets are the strongest and the biggest electrical fields that envelop us. But at the distance we are from them, it's a very weak signal. But consciousness operates on a very weak signal. So that means it affects us. So the strong transmissions of the Wi-Fi towers and the cell phone towers are proven to adversely affect the heart and the nervous system.
Yeah, you know,
so what you want to do...
What I did when we moved into this house is I had them take the smart meter off the house because it was putting out a signal that was like really, really strong. And not to mention the fact that it lowered my electrical bill quite a bit, too. But I think these, if we could see what we're swimming around in, we would be amazed at the electromagnetic frequencies that are in our world right now.
So you take one of these, which is a tri-field meter, a good one, right. And you switch it to microwave radio mode, and you'll see if there's any activity. And right now, when you put this near a smart meter, that needle will just go flying all the way up for a second. It pulses, because I've done it.
Huh.
And I found that the only metal, we tested with meters, the only metal that will really block a smart meter is tungsten. And unfortunately, tungsten is so expensive to melt. It's not expensive to buy a chunk of it, but to get a sheet of it is about $400 for a sheet this big, a foot by foot, and nobody sells it. But basically, I was going to make those for smart meters, and then people came out with blockers, and I tested them, and they don't block it at all.
Right.
You cannot block the strength of one of those things. Man, you need tungsten, and it's my gift to the world. Whoever can make a tungsten shield affordable, go ahead and try, because that is the only thing that'll do it. I've tested every metal there is, and yeah, that much steel will block a lot of it. So if you can get like an inch thick plate of steel, but the problem is for the power companies is they need a reading of the meter from the outside of the house. So you would hang that quarter inch or half inch steel plate on the inside of the wall so that the microwaves are getting dampened and that are trying to go into the house and hit the human system. But it's still the way the waves spin and the way they go out, they tend to get everywhere, and yeah. Microwaves are quite harmful. So my theory is, why don't we just reharmonize the microwaves? Believe it or not, this will sound shocking. Water.
Would you like to learn more about biological entities in our atmosphere? And could it be that we're living in a living organism that is in fact healing our atmosphere? Visit www.spiritualactivist.com to watch the rest of this interview. Thank you.